tuned for Lialogos Radio, the weekly radio program featuring the best in Greek music and culture, plus interviews with Greek and international newsmakers. Lialogos Radio with Michael Nevaralekis begins now.
Γιατί και όχι αδικά. Όπως κοιμάσαι στα στενά παλιά λαδάδικα. Έγινες φήμη και γι' αυτό δεν φυλακίζεσαι. Ζεις στο σκοτάδι παστρικά, μα δεν ορκίζεσαι. Λάμπεις τα κόκκινα σατέν που σε τυλίγουνε. Άσπροι και σέρτικοι καπνοί σε καταπίνουνε. Σε καλδερή μια ξενυχθάς υγρά λιθοστρώτα. Του πληρωμένου παράδεισου την αυλόπορτα. Μοναξιές με σένα σμίγανε. Φεύγαν καράβια μα πριν φύγουν σου σφυρίζανε. Πόσα παιδιά ήρθαν να βρουν το αντριλίκι τους και σου ακουμπήσανε δειλά το καρτζιλίκι τους. Τόσα δίνω πόσα θες στα λαμπάδικα πουλάν αυτό που θες. Τόσα παίρνω κι ό,τι θες στη τιμή περιλαμβάνε το καφές. Τόσα δίνω πόσα θες στα λαμπάδικα πουλάν αυτό που θες. Τόσα παίρνω κι ό,τι θες στη τιμή περιλαμβάνε το καφέ.
That was Dimitris Mitropanos getting us started today with a live version of one of his very best songs titled Talaladika. This is the Alois Radio, the Greek radio program which brings together the global Greek community each week on 14 radio stations across 5 countries, 4 continents, and online. My name is Michael Nevaradakis, and on today's program, we are excited to present, as part of the Alois interview series, one of the biggest interviews in the Alois Radio's 4-year history. We will be speaking with renowned scholar and author Henry Giroux in what promises to be an intriguing discussion about the ever-increasing influence of neoliberalism and its impacts on politics, the economy, education, and society as a whole in Greece, Europe, the United States, and the entire Western world. This interview is coming up in just a few moments, and following today's edition of the Dialogos interview series, stay tuned for our commentary of the week, as well as our special musical tribute to one of the most legendary Greek Cypriot musicians of the 20th century, All that and more will follow in today's broadcast, but coming up right now is this week's edition of the Dialogos interview series and our interview with renowned professor and author Henry Giroux. the Diálogos Interview Series, our weekly segment featuring interviews on matters pertaining to Greece and the worldwide Greek community, coming up next here on Diálogos Radio. Joining us today on Diálogos Radio and the Diálogos Interview Series is Professor Henry Giroux, the Chair for Scholarship in the Public Interest at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario. Henry has previously held posts at Boston University, at Miami University in Ohio, and at Penn State University. He is also the author of a number of books, including Youth in Revolt, Reclaiming a Democratic Future, and Neoliberalism's War on Public Education. He has also made countless television and radio appearances on outlets all across the world. Henry, thank you for joining us today on our program.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Let's begin with a discussion about some topics which you've spoken and written extensively about, neoliberalism and what you have described as casino capitalism. How have these ideas taken hold politically and intellectually across the world in recent years?
I think since the 1970s, it's been the predominant ideology, certainly in Western Europe and in North America. And to say the least, it raised havoc in Latin America, as we well know, in Argentina and Chile and a number of other states. But of course, it also began in Chile as a result of the Chicago Boys. Milton Friedman and his that group went down to, of course, I think it went down to Argentina, sorry, and basically used the Pinochet regime as a kind of testing tube to sort of produce a whole series of policies. But I think if we look at this very specifically, what we're talking about is we're talking about a number of things. I mean, we're talking about an ideology marked by the belief that profit is basically the essence, making money is making basically the essence of democracy, and that consumption is the only operable form of citizenship. But even more than that, it kind of upholds the notion that the market kind of serves as a model for structuring all social relations, not just the economy, but the governing of all of social life. And I think as a mode of governance, it's really quite dreadful, because it tends to produce identities, subjects, ways of life, driven by a kind of survival of the fittest ethic, grounded in the notion of the free, possessive individual, and committed to the right of individual and ruling groups to accrue wealth removed from matters of ethics and social cause. That's a key issue. I mean, this is a particular political and economic and social project that not only consolidates class power in the hands of the 1%, but it operates off the assumption that economics really can divorce itself from social cause, that it really doesn't have to deal with matters of ethical and social responsibility, that these things get in the way. And I think we see that in a whole range of policies across the globe. We see the attack on the welfare state. We see the privatization of public services, the dismantling of the connection between private issues and public problems, the selling off of state functions, deregulation, the emergence of a kind of rabid individualism, the refusal to tax the rich, and really the redistribution of wealth from the middle and working classes to basically the ruling classes, the elite classes, what the Occupy movement called the 1%. I mean, it really has created a very bleak emotional and economic landscape for 99% certainly of the population throughout the world.
And having mentioned this impact on the social state in the 99%, would you go as far as to say that these ideologies have been the direct cause of the economic crisis that the world is presently experiencing?
Oh, I absolutely. I mean, I think that when you look at the crisis in 2007, what are you looking at? I mean, you're looking at a kind of pathological greed that implemented banking policies that deregulated the financial world and allowed the financial elite to, in a sense, put through a series of policies around particularly selling junk bonds and the illegality of what we call subprime mortgages to people who couldn't pay for them, created a bubble and exploded. I mean, this is directly related to the assumption that the market should drive all aspects of political, economic, and social life. And what we saw is that it failed. And it not only failed, it caused an enormous amount of cruelty and hardship throughout the world. But more importantly, it rebounded. I mean, it rebounded and in a sense was entirely unapologetic about what it did, and then went on, particularly in the United States under, you know, the Rubin boys, along with Larry Summers and others, it attempted actually to prevent any policies from being implemented that would have overturned this massively failed policy of deregulation.
Henry, to build on your last point, how has this growth in neoliberal thought and doctrine contributed, in your view, to a democratic deficit nowadays in Europe and in the United States?
Well, I mean, democracy really has become two things for, I think, a whole range of anti-democratic politicians, anti-public intellectuals, and you know, the people that support these policies. I mean, a democracy basically is a word they use, but they've emptied it out to basically mean that it's a democracy for the rich, meaning that it's a term that has nothing to do with questions of justice, nothing to do with questions of rights, nothing to do with questions of legality. As a matter of fact, it becomes a kind of front term, a kind of counterfeit term that's used to justify a whole range of policies that actually are anti-democratic. It's oxymoronic. I mean, the other side of this is that it hates democracy. Neoliberalism hates democracy. It feeds on inequality, it feeds on privilege, it feeds on a massive divisiveness, and it feeds on a theater of cruelty. I mean, all you have to do is look at the way in which it enshrines a kind of rabid individualism. It believes that privatization is the essence of all relationships. It works very hard to eliminate any investment in public values and in public trust. It believes that democracy is something that doesn't work, and we increasingly see this, and we increasingly hear this. I mean, what I'm shocked to see about, you know, neoliberalism in all of its forms is how utterly unapologetic it is about the misery it produces. And it's unapologetic not just in that it says we don't care because we have a punishing state that will actually take care of, you know, young black kids and dissenting college students and you know, dissenting professors who basically don't believe in this stuff. We'll take care of them. But it also blames the very victims that suffer as a result of these policies. I mean, you know, the language of character now, I mean, the language of personal responsibility without linking private issues or private troubles to larger public considerations is really pathological. I mean, it has an utter disdain for communal relationships, an utter disdain for unions, for public servants. Anything to do with the public is seen as the enemy. Whether we're talking about public transit or we're talking about public schools, because these things in their eyes should be privatized. They should be sold over. They're assets. They're seen as assets for which people can make money. They're not seen as institutions that somehow contribute to a formative culture that's essential for any viable democracy.
And having mentioned public education just now, a big issue in Greece, as well as in many other countries today, is the increasing privatization of education. And certainly this is something that has been promoted heavily during the crisis in many of these countries. How has neoliberalism and casino capitalism impacted the quality of education and also access to education?
I think it's a terrific question. I mean, around the quality, it's dumbed down education to the point where it literally believes in a way that's hard to fathom or understand for anyone who believes that schools should have something to do with creating critically thoughtful, engaged young people who not only have a sense of their own agency and integrity and possibility, but really believe they can make a difference in the world. It tells them that the only thing that really matters is testing. That basically we need to educate people for tests. And what it's really saying is that thinking is dangerous. I mean, it's a policy that basically suggests that education is not about creating critically informed young people. It's really about training. And it's about training for the workforce. So it does two things. It tends to promote a kind of political and ideological conformity. It's a depoliticizing process. And it's also oppressive. Because it removes from education any sense of vision that suggests that education is really about thinking about a future that doesn't repeat the worst dimensions of the present. And so I think in that sense, this emphasis on rote memorization, this emphasis on testing, this emphasis on discipline, as you know, many of these schools are being turned into military academies, many high schools, particularly in Chicago. And I think that what it does is it ignores all those basic problems that matter, in which schools have to be understood in order to be reformed. And that is, whether we're talking about inequality, whether we're talking about poverty, whether we're talking about racism, kids can't learn if they're hungry. I mean, kids can't learn if they find themselves in schools where there are no resources. Kids can't learn in classes that have 40 students in them. You know, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure this out. And I think that what you really need to figure out is that the right knows this. This is not just a kind of willful ignorance. I mean, this is a very systemic policy to make sure that if education is going to matter, it's going to matter for the elite. It's not going to matter for everybody else in the sense of offering the best possible resources and capabilities that it can offer.
Would you go as far as saying that education, and particularly higher education today, actually reinforce neoliberal doctrine inside the classroom?
Oh, I don't think there's any. I mean, I don't think there's any question about this. I mean, you can pick up the paper every day and read the idiocy that comes out of the mouths of these administrators, whether you're talking about Texas or you're talking about Arizona, or whether you're talking about New England. I mean, the university is being corporatized in a way that we've never seen before. And we know what that means. I mean, we know what the conditions are that are producing this. At one level, you have right-wing governors, and you have basically a center-right president, and you have a bunch of Democrats who really should be a Republicans light, who really believe that, you know, we can defund education while at the same time funding jets such as the F-35 jet. The F-35 Joint Strike Fighter jet, which cost, by the way, $100 million apiece. But they will not provide funds to allow education to be free for every kid in the United States. In 10 years, it's going to cost $1 trillion for these jets. And they don't work. They can't fly in the rain. I mean, you know, the military budget is bloated. It's the largest in the world. You can combine the next 10 military budgets and the 125 military budgets. They don't add up to the cost of America's military budget. So you have this misappropriation of money. Not that we don't have the money for education. It's how we appropriate those funds. We don't appropriate them in the interest of young people. We don't appropriate them in the interest of education. And so as education is being defunded, what happens is you have these business models now being incorporated into university, which calls, for instance, administrators CEOs. And by the way, as you know, they're the largest rising group in education in the United States. Administrators now outnumber faculty. And they're draining huge amounts of resources away from students. Secondly, of course, faculty have lost power. I mean, faculty now, they're abolishing unions. The dissent is being cracked down in ways that are abominable and remind us of the McCarthy period. You have faculty who basically are being defined by the degree to which they can write grants. Subjects that don't lend themselves immediately to training are going to cost more for students in states like Texas. Texas went so far as to claim that it would lower tuition for those faculties and courses that lent themselves directly to business interests. Can you imagine, while raising the tuition for courses in the humanities and the liberal arts, which these right-wing governors claim contribute nothing to basically the economy? So you're really dealing with, and of course students, on the other hand, are now seen as consumers. They're not seen as important investments in the future around questions of particularly a democratic future. They're just seen as slots. You know, and so that's why there's a big purge in the university. I'm sorry, a big push in the university for foreign students, because they're a cash cow. That's how we talk about these things now. So I think the university is in crisis, and it's in a terrible crisis over what's going on in terms of its inability to really take advantage of a mission that in the 50s and the 60s, for all of its contradictions and for all of its problems, at least had a sense that it was more than simply a job training opportunity, or that the university was more than an adjunct of the military-industrial complex.
We are speaking with professor and author Henry Giroux here on the Dialogos Radio and the Dialogos interview series. And Henry, building on what you said about the university being in crisis, how has the shift that has taken place impacted education, specifically in the liberal arts and the humanities? And how has it impacted the job market for academics? There are many in Greece, for instance, who view an academic career overseas as a way out of the crisis in their country.
Well, I think two things have happened. I mean, I think that The liberal arts and the humanities are basically seen as useless. I mean, they don't correlate well with the notion of the university as a factory. they don't correlate well with the university as a place that really is less interested in critical thinking, teaching kids how to think critically than teaching them how to be semi-skilled workers. And it doesn't work well with the governing structure in the university that in some fundamental way says, hey, look, power is basically in the hands of CEOs. It's a business culture. We'll tell you what to do. And matters of vision and matters of critique and matters of analysis, and which are not simply invested in the humanities and the liberal arts, but the liberal arts and the humanities have a long history of supporting those ideals. Those ideals are not simply not in favor at this moment in higher education, except for the elite schools. They basically are seen as they're scorned. They get in the way. You know, they create problems for administrators who don't want cranky faculty, who don't want students basically learning how to think, who don't want to mimic the traditions that went on in the 1960s. I mean, they're utterly petrified over what happened in the 60s. I mean, not only did you have students demanding all kinds of things from, you know, more inclusive courses, eliminating the racism, making schools more democratic. But you opened up schools, and this relates to your second question, you opened up schools in ways that allowed for the education of a variety of subordinate groups that in the past were excluded from education. This utterly petrified the right. The fact that you could, you know, that blacks, that minorities, that immigrants could actually become educated, was a terrifying assumption for many right-wingers, to say the least. And I think that what we see now is, and you have to connect the dots here. Remember, you have a Republican Party in the United States that is doing everything it can to violate the Voting Rights Act. It's trying to limit as much as possible the ability of black people to vote. Think about how that correlates so easily with making sure that tuitions are so high in the schools that you would exclude working class people, poor minorities, people who are considered disposable, people who basically would never be able to afford unless they had adequate funds, adequate grants, adequate scholarships. I mean, this is really not just about an economic, a predatory economic system trying to redistribute wealth from students to administrators to, you know, to the military-industrial complex or the financial elite. It's also basically about a systemic policy of exclusion. And so, yes, I mean, I think around questions of opportunity, as tuitions raise, get raised to unbelievable heights, and you have endless students who, A, can't get in because the tuition is too high, or you have students who will be saddled with debt for the rest of their lives in a way that they would never even imagine going into public service, because it basically doesn't provide the salaries that the private, that the, you know, the private system does, the private market does. And I think when you begin to put these dots together, you can see how crucial education is to this neoliberal project.
Henry, people in Greece oftentimes have this perception that the international media operates on a very objective and credible basis. How do you see the media's role, however, in reinforcing the system of neoliberalism and casino capitalism?
I think it's silly. It borders on being silly, if not utterly naive, to assume that the media is somehow removed from questions of power. I mean, look, in the United States, you know, the statistics are very clear. You have six major companies that control the media. I mean, the media is in the hands of corporate power. I mean, whether we're talking about Fox News or any of these other, you know, right-wing groups, the Murdochs that control the media. I mean, where do you see left-wing analysis in the dominant media? I mean, almost never. Almost never. But if you look at the new media, you know, if you look at alternative media, like, you know, the radio station I'm on right now, you know, there is a new space that's opened up, and that's very, very encouraging. And it speaks to the cracks in the system and the inability of the system in light of these new technologies to be able to wage the kind of control that they have in the past. So in spite of that concentrated power, economic power over the media, which is far from objective and not biased, unbiased. As I said, that's silly. I mean, that the media is completely basically tuned into, you know, maintaining a class system at any cost. And whether that means completely destroying a country like Greece or Spain or Portugal or Chile or Argentina, they have no trouble with that. They don't think twice about that. I mean, these people are basically ideological lackeys. You know, they're in the service of the financial elite, and that's what they do. They do their job. But the claim that they're objective is just simply, you know, makes no sense to me.
We are speaking with Professor and author Henry Giroux here on the Dialogos Radio and the Dialogos interview series. And Henry, from a political point of view, we've seen a rising tide of authoritarianism and official far-right parties making electoral gains in recent years. On the other hand, we've perhaps seen a failure of the left to respond to this new political climate. How would you characterize the response of the global left to this trend that we have been discussing?
I think there's something missing from the left, and I think there are three things missing from the left that need to be addressed. And I think we need to be careful in assuming that the left has failed as much as the left is learning as quickly as it possibly can what it needs to do in light of policies it's used in the past that don't basically work anymore in a world in which politics has become globalized. And I think the three things are this. First, I think that the left has to become an international left. I mean, the world is now, power is now separated from politics, meaning that power is global and politics is local. So that local politics really has very little power. States have very little power over corporate sovereignty anymore. They can't control it. It has an allegiance to no one. It floats. It floats above national boundaries. And so we have to begin to think about ways to create movements, laws, policies that actually deal with this kind of global network of power. That's the first thing. Secondly, I think the left has got to take the question of education seriously. I mean, education is not marginal to politics. It's central to politics. If we can't create the formative culture globally that allows people to understand that their interests are being trampled on, that they live in a political system that has been constructed by human beings and can be overturned by human beings, but also a political and economic and social system that has nothing to do with their needs, that basically exploits their needs. Thirdly, it seems to me that the left has got to get beyond demonstrations. I mean, it's got to come up with a kind of international vision of what it wants to do, flexible, and it can work in associations, but it's got to have an organization that basically can have some clout. And in some cases, that means it can be involved in local elections, and in some cases, it can develop third parties, and in some cases, it can work with NGOs. But it's got to take the question of power seriously. Power is not just a one-shot deal. It doesn't mean you demonstrate in the street with 200,000 people and then you walk away. It's got to become more systemic. We need more than what my friend Stanley Aronowitz calls signpost politics. You know, the politics of banners. That's good. It draws attention. That's a pedagogical moment. But we have to go far beyond that. We need to create ideologically, politically, educationally, international organizations that can begin to bring their weight to bear on this global politics that now controls basically state politics in nations all over the world.
Henry, before we wrap up, where can our listeners find out more details about you, your work, and especially the Public Intellectuals Project, which you founded, if I'm not mistaken?
Yeah, I did. Well, the Public Intellectual Project is located at truthout.org. And if you go there, you'll see on the right, there's something called the Public Intellectual Project. You click on it, and what you get is a whole series of articles now being written by intellectuals all over the world who are addressing very important social issues in accessible language. I mean, theory is not being compromised. It's just being made accessible. But it's also being linked to issues that really matter. I mean, secondly, you can my own way, I hate to be self-promoting, but I have a website that I think is important. It's www.henryagiroux.com. And anybody who's interested in my work, all of my work is listed there. And so I think that if you know, there is a concern about some of the things that we're talking about, please go there and you have access to a whole range of information.
Henry, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us today here on the Dialogos Radio and the Dialogos interview series.
Okay, thank you very much for interviewing me.
Attention iTunes users, the Dialogos Radio is now just a click away. You can now download our podcasts and listen to the Dialogos Radio 24/7 anytime, anywhere. Check us out today in the iTunes podcast directory and in iTunes Radio. We just wrapped up this week's edition of the Diálogos interview series and our interview with the renowned professor, scholar, and author Henry Giroux. As with all of our interviews and features, the podcast of this interview will soon be available on our website, dialogosmedia.org, as well as on the Diálogos Radio apps for Android, Kindle, and BlackBerry devices, in iTunes and TuneIn.com, in the Windows Marketplace, and in the WeCast app for iPhones and for iPads. More great Greek music will follow here on Diálogos Radio, and coming up in just a few moments is our commentary of the week, plus our special musical tribute to Manos Loizos.
Ραγίζει το Σαββάτο στις γειτονιές. Στα βελούδινα χυλάκια κόκκινο κραγιόν μπαίνεις μες στα πηγαδάκια κι οι άντρες φανταράκια λένε παρόν. Στα κουνήματα της μέσης χάνω τις στροφές κι ώσπου να σε σημαδέψω το βλέμμα σου να κλέψω γινόμαι χτες. Γκέι φωτιές αχ, τον είδα να σ' ανάβει και να πουλά στο χάδι με πυρκαγιές. Στα βελούδινα χυλάκια κόκκινο κραγιόν μπαίνεις μες στα πηγαδάκια κι οι άντρες πανταράκια λένε παρόν. Κουνήματα της μέσης χάνω τις στροφές κι ώσπου να σε σημαδεύσω το βλέμμα σου να κλέψω γινόμαι χτες. Φανταράκια λένε παρόν. Στα κουνήματα της μέσης χάνω τις στροφές κι ώσπου να σε σημαδέψω το βλέμμα σου να κλέψω γινόμαι χθες. Άγγελος είναι βροχή και αέρας, χώμα και σώμα ένα. Φτάνει ο καλός μου, το φως του κόσμου, δεν βλέπω πια κανένα. Φέρτε βριλάντια, φέρτε διαμάντια, φέρτε ασήμι, φέρτε μου χρυσό, φέρτε μου ρούχα, τα όνειρα που είχα σήμερα θα δειθώ. Κανένα. Φέρτε γυρλάντες, φέρτε μου μπάντες, φτάνει ο καλός μου και έχουμε γιορτή. Φέρτε μου δώρα, πολύ τη χώρα έρχεται την αυγή. Φέρτε βριλάντια, φέρτε διαμάντια, φέρτε ασήμι, φέρτε μου χρυσό, φέρτε μου ρούχα, τα όνειρα που θα δειθώ.
This is the Alagos Radio, the official media sponsor of the U.S. screening tour of acclaimed Greek documentary Palikari, Louis Tikas and the Ludlow Massacre, a screening tour which is currently in progress and for which we have more information available on our website, thealagosmedia.org. We just heard Alkistis Protopsati with a song titled Yorti, while right before that we heard Eleni Vitali with Veludina Filakia. Coming up next here on the Alagos Radio is our commentary of the week. The Alagos Radio's Commentary of the Week. Each week, Michael Navratakis provides views and opinions on issues pertaining to Greece and to the worldwide Greek community. Coming up next, here on The Alagos Radio. Just a few days ago, on September 18th, rallies were held throughout Greece and in many other cities across Europe to commemorate the one-year anniversary since the violent murder of Greek anti-fascist rapper Pavlos Fissas, who was stabbed by Golden Dawn member Yorgos Rupakias in Athens one day prior. The murder of Fissas set off a firestorm of anger against the far-right Golden Dawn party in Greece and likely pressured the Greek government, which up until that point had essentially supported Golden Dawn's actions, to proceed with the arrests of several prominent and not-so-prominent members of the party, even if since then the government has gone back to its tacit support of Golden Dawn and its activities. The one-year anniversary of Fissas' murder brought out huge crowds of anti-fascist demonstrators in Athens and most of Greece's major cities, and in major European cities as well. Protest marches and concerts were organized, and this was certainly the largest set of demonstrations and marches that the anti-fascist movement, or any movement for that matter, has organized in Greece so far this year. Therein, however, lies the problem. As far as I'm aware, Greece is still experiencing a crippling economic crisis, with 1.5 million people unemployed, with hundreds of thousands more living below the poverty line, with still more harsh economic measures being imposed on the population, including a hefty and likely illegal unified property tax that passed by only one vote in the 100-member summer session of parliament, and only after the ruling New Democracy Party replaced several of its members of parliament in order to find enough representatives that were willing to vote yes for this new tax. There have been almost 5,000 suicides in Greece since the onset of the crisis, and it has been reported that over 250,000 young and educated Greeks have migrated abroad. Education, healthcare, and the social state have been decimated, as has freedom of the press. Yet, there are no rallies for any of the above issues, no protests, no marches, no real nationwide organized movements to oppose this endless tide of austerity, cuts, privatization, and misery. There are no rallies in a memory of the thousands who have committed suicide, or those who lost their life when a branch of Marfin Bank was burned down in an arson attack during anti-austerity protests in Athens in 2010. No rallies for all those who are leaving the country and for the families that are being separated. It seems that Greece's anti-fascist movement has, quite frankly, lost the forest for the trees. In the interview which we heard earlier today, Henry Giroux stated that we need to move beyond demonstrations. But in the case of Greece, other than an occasional demonstration here and there, such as those that were organized on the anniversary of Fisas's murder, it seems that society has not even reached that stage. Instead, hopelessness, helplessness, self-loathing, a misappropriated anger at anything that is Greek, and a demoralized woe-is-me attitude reign supreme. Amongst all the hardships Greece has endured during this latest crisis, this perhaps is the greatest tragedy of all, in a country which thousands of years ago invented tragedy. Take the Dialogos Radio on the go with you with the new Dialogos Radio app for Android devices. Now you can listen live to the Dialogos Radio and the Dialogos Radio 24/7, download our podcasts, and read our latest articles, all in our free Android app, available now in the Google Play Store. That was the commentary of the week here on the Dialogos Radio. Stay tuned for our special musical tribute dedicated to Manos Loizos.
Καφένε στου λιμάνιου, την άκρη τον έχτισε το δάκρυ αυτόν που με αυτών που μένουνε και περιμένουνε. Καφένε που ακούει όλο, τα ίδια για μπάρκα και ταξίδια αυτών που με αυτών που μένουνε και περιμένουνε. Καφένε, ένα πάνιο ρημάδι, αχ να τανε καράβι για αυτούς που με μένουνε
We started off our special musical tribute to the legendary composer and musician Manos Loizos just now with one of his classic compositions, a song performed by Yorgos Dalaras from 1970 titled Echo Enan Kafene. Manos Loizos, who was born reportedly either in Cyprus or in Alexandria, Egypt on October 22, 1937, got involved with music at an early age in Alexandria, but later relocated to Athens to attend college. However, after bouncing around from program to program, he abandoned his studies and began to increasingly focus on his music. He composed music for his first record in 1962 titled To Tragudi του Dromu, with lyrics by Federico García Lorca and vocals by Yorgos Moutsios, but his time in Greece was cut short after the military coup of 1967 when Loizos left for England. However, he returned the following year, and throughout the 1970s, he had the opportunity to work with some of the major names of Greek music at the time, including Dimitra Galani, Yorgos Dalaras, Stelios Kazantzidis, Maria Faranduri, Yannis Kalaitzis, Vasilis Papakostandinou, and many others. However, his life ended prematurely on September 17, 1982, after suffering several consecutive strokes. Loizos, in his relatively short musical career, composed some of Greece's most famous songs, songs which remain beloved to this day, while 2007 was declared the year of Manos Loizos in Greece. We'll hear two more songs by Loizos now, continuing our special tribute here on the Alagos Radio.
Βρίσκει ο χαρός στο φτερό. Τα ελάφια όταν σκύβουν για με μαχαίρι.
ακολουθώ στην τσέπη σου γλιστρά σαν τη φρακάκι όσο θα μικρό. Σ' ακολουθώ και ξέρω πως χωράω μες στο λακάκι που έχει στο λαιμό. Έλα κράτησέ με και περπάτησέ με μες στο μαγικό σου το βυθό. Πάρε με μαζί σου στο βαθύ φιλί σου, μη μ' αφήνεις μόνο θα χαθώ. Σ' ακολουθώ και ξέρω πως χωράω μες στο λακάκι που έχει στο λαιμό. Σου κολλάω σαν φανελάκι καλοκαιρινό. Σ' ακολουθώ, σ' αγγίζω και πονάω. Κλείνω τα μάτια και σ' ακολουθώ. Έλα κράτησέ με και περπάτησέ με μες στο μαγικό σου το βυθό. Πάρε με μαζί σου στο βαθύ φιλί σου, μη μ' αφήνεις μόνο θα χαθώ. Σ' ακολουθώ σαν φανελάκι καλοκαιρινό. Σ' ακολουθώ, σ' αγγίζω και πονάω. Κλείνω τα μάτια και σ' ακολουθώ.
Follow Diálogos Radio on Facebook and Twitter and remain connected to all our latest news and updates. Check us out today at facebook.com/dialogosmedia and at twitter.com/dialogosmedia. Two more beautiful songs composed by the late Manos Loizos as part of our special musical tribute to him here on the Diálogos Radio, taking us in two different musical directions, with Vasilis Papakostaninou singing Sakolutho, and before that, Dimitris Basis with his rendition of Ia Mousa Parakalo. This is, of course, the Diálogos Radio, the worldwide Greek radio program that is heard on 14 radio stations across 5 countries, 4 continents, and online. The Diálogos Radio is the official media sponsor for the U.S. screening tour of the acclaimed Greek documentary Palikari, Louis Tikas and the Ludlow Massacre. And we have more details about the screening tour, which is currently in progress, on our website, dialogosmedia.org. On our website, you can also find our podcasts, all of our on-demand programming, you can listen to our online radio station, the Diálogos Radio 24/7, and you can read our latest articles, including our most recent piece, published in Truthout, which is the first in a multi-part investigative series examining the long and troubled history of censorship, lawlessness, and corruption in Greece's media landscape, a situation which is getting worse in recent years. You can find all of that and much more on dialogosmedia.org, on facebook.com/dialogosmedia, and on twitter.com/dialogosmedia. Today's program is just about ready to come to a close, but we'll be back again next week, same time, same place, with an interview with economist Rania Andonopoulou, as well as some great Greek music and much, much more. As for today, we'll wrap up our broadcast with one final song, also composed by Manos Loizos in 1980 and sung by Haris Alexiou, titled Ola Se Thimizun. Thank you very much for joining us once again this week, and have a wonderful weekend.
Όλα σε θυμίζουν απλά κι αγαπημένα πράγματα δικά σου καθημερινά, σαν να περιμένουν κι αυτά μαζί με μένα. Να'ρθεις κι ας χαράξει για στερνή φορά. Όλη μας η αγάπη την κάμαρα γεμίζει σαν ένα τραγούδι που λέγαμε κι οι δυο. Πρόσωπα και λόγια και το όνειρο που τρίζει σαν θα ξημερώσει τι θα είναι αληθινό. Όλα σε θυμίζουν απλά και αγαπημένα πράγματα δικά σου καθημερινά. Θυμίζουν κι οι πιο καλοί μας φίλοι άλλο στην ταβέρνα, άλλο σινέμα. Μόνη μου διαβάζω το γράμμα που είχε στείλει πριν να φιληθούμε πρώτη μας φορά. Όλη μας η αγάπη την κάμαρα γεμίζει σαν ένα τραγούδι που λέγαμε κι οι δυο. Πρόσωπα και λόγια και το όνειρο που τρίζει σαν θα ξημερώσει τι θα είναι αληθινό. Όλα σε θυμίζουν απλά και αγαπημένα τα δικά σου καθημερινά.